as we prepare for Pesach, there are so many different aspects of Pesach that we need to focus on. But one aspect that we may not focus on that much, but we hear a lot about, is the issue of eating kidneys on Pesach. Do we have any women who are Sfardiyot in the room? Okay, so you will notice that there's a major divide between Sfardi communities and Ashkenazi communities when it comes to eating kidneys on Pesach. What I want to get into today is trying to understand this fascinating discussion. Where does it all come from? Why is there a divide? And what the issue is, or perhaps non-issue, with eating kidneys on Pesach. We begin with a pasuk in Parshas Bechukosai. In the final pasuk in Sefer Vayikra, the Torah tells us basically a recap of everything that has been outlined until this point in the Torah. The Torah tells us as follows: Ela hamitzvos hasher tziva Hashem es Moshe el bnei Yisrael b'har Sinai. These are the mitzvos that HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanded Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai. That sounds like a pretty innocuous pasuk, nothing really going on there, but yet the Gemara says, from here we learn, it's a Gemara Masechta Shabbos Kuf Dalid, Mikan, from here we learn, She'ein ha-Navi rashoi lachadesh davar me'ata. From here we learn that a Navi is not allowed to make a new institution. A Navi is not allowed to establish any new mitzvah. And the Torah Tamima explains what the Gemara is saying, and he writes, Ki rak Moshe ha-Navi mechoke kator bi'ikara. Moshe Rabbeinu is the only one who has a right to come up with the mitzvahs HaTorah. And of course, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't come up with them. Moshe Rabbeinu just gave them to us from HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. So that is what the Gemara tells us very clearly, that a Navi, as great as he may be, has no right to make a new institution. This is underscored once again in Parshas Va'eschanan, when the Torah tells us, Lo sosifu al hadavar velo sigru mimenu. We're not allowed to add to the mitzvahs HaTorah. We're not allowed to reduce any of the mitzvahs HaTorah. We cannot change anything that the Torah describes as being a mitzvah. We can't put anything more, and we cannot take anything less. So, what you see clearly is, there's a fierce insistence, there's a demand, that everything remain exactly as it is. At the same time, we also have a pasuk in Parshas Acharimos, where the Torah says, Ushmartem es mishmarti. What does that mean, Ushmartem es mishmarti? So, if I were to translate the words, it would mean, make sure not to violate a lo sase. Ushmartem es mishmarti. Make sure that all of the things that I told you to abide by, you abide by. But the Gemara Maseches Yevamos Daf Chaf Alef says it means something beyond that. Ushmartem es mishmarti means asu mishmeres le mishmarti. You have to make sure to put safeguards in place. You have to make sure to preserve the mitzvah HaTorah. And how do you do that? By putting a safeguard in place to make sure that you don't violate a mitzvah in the Torah. Which means, basically, that every generation has leaders of the generation who have to look at the challenges that are facing that generation and figure out what safeguards can they put in place based on the realities of today to make sure that our generation does not do anything that they shouldn't do against the laws of the Torah. That's basically what it means. And obviously, this would be a blatant contradiction to the original pasuk. What does the first pasuk say? Lo sosifu velo sigru. You're not allowed to add on to the mitzvahs HaTorah. The Torah says, Eila HaMitzvos, whatever HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave to Moshe Rabbeinu and passed down to us since then, is where the mitzvah starts and ends. More than that, you don't have a right to do. So what does it mean when the Torah then says, Asu Mishmeres LeMishmarti? That's obviously a contradiction. And the Rambam addresses this issue and he says, how can it be that the Torah instructs us to do both? It doesn't go together. And the Rambam answers that perhaps the way to understand this is, of course, the leadership of every generation has to make sure that they put safeguards in place from their understanding of what the generation needs, of what the challenges are, and of where the pitfalls may lie. That is how they need to determine how to go about making takanos in every generation. However, says the Rambam, in doing so, when they make a gzera derabanan, when they make a takana derabanan, they have to make sure that it is presented properly. They have to make sure that they tell everyone, that they inform them of the truth. They have to say, this is what the Torah prescribes, this is a mitzvah midoraisa, and this category of what we're talking about now is only a takana derabanan, and the rules are going to be different, safek deraisa lechumra, safek derabanan lekula. How this works is that we have to just clearly identify what is the araisa, what is the rabbanan, what is the takana, what is the gzera. But says the Rambam, so long as you do that, you're not fooling anybody to believe that this is an actual biblical obligation, then it would be okay. One thing to point out as we're talking about this is, the Mesilas Yesharim has a very interesting idea, where he says, usually we assume that the responsibility of creating safeguards for our observance of mitzvos lies on the Beis Din, or on the leadership of any generation. as they survey what's going on, as they see what the issues of the time are, that is how they respond with their takanos or their gzeiros. However, says the Mesilas Yesharim, it really falls on every individual person as well. If I see that I have a particular aspect of my life that is challenging for me, if I see that I have problems with whatever it may be, then I should set up safeguards for myself to make sure that I don't violate. I don't wait for someone above me to make that safeguard. They don't know me. They don't know what my challenges are. It would be the best, says the Mesilas Yesharim, if each person would set up a safeguard on their own to make sure that they don't violate an aveira. You know, we have people who violate all kinds of isuri arayos, people who do things that are inappropriate between the different genders. Well, then set up a safeguard. You know, Chazal said there's an isur of yichud. So that's not setting a safeguard. Chazal did that. Why did they make the isur yichud? Because they know how tempting it is for people to do something wrong when they are in seclusion. Now, we know when it comes to the laws of yichud that there are all kinds of ways to get around the yichud. Leave the door open, whatever, Pesach, Pasuach, L'Rishus HaRabin, things like that, Baila Ba'ir. Maybe if you feel that you are the kind of person that is struggling with this issue, take an extra chumrah upon yourself and say, even though Pesach, Pasuach is okay, even though if I have an open door that's unlocked, it's okay, but you know what? I'm not going to rely on that. I'm never going to be miyached with another person if I know that it can lead to something wrong, because I don't want to rely on the kula when it comes to that yichud issue, because I know how much I am prone to falling or slipping in this area of life. So again, it applies to every aspect of our lives and everything we do, but that is what the Mesilas Yesharim tells us from this pasuk of Asu Mishmeres LeMishmarti. Now, all of this presents a very significant issue when we try to understand how Chanukah and Purim came to be. Because the truth is, Mordechai and Esther lived way after the times of Moshe Rabbeinu. And even later than Mordechai and Esther was the story of Chanukah. So how could it be that you have an entirely new holiday, a new institution of Chanukah and Purim, when it has nothing to do with Moshe Rabbeinu? It is not a safeguard, it's not a siyug, it's not because we are afraid of something else going wrong and therefore Chanukah was instituted. It doesn't make sense. So how did Chanukah and Purim come to be? And in fact, that is what the Yerushalmi and Megillah struggles with, where the Yerushalmi writes, Hayu mitzdarim ala davar. The Chachamim, the leaders of the generation, were having a very difficult time justifying how do we allow Chanukah and Purim to become part of the Jewish calendaric year? What exactly are they? What right do we have to add another mitzvah of Mikra Megillah and a mitzvah of Neiros Chanukah and all the different things that we do, Mishloach Manos, Matanos Le'Avyonim, when this has nothing to do with the Takana D'Rabbanan at all? And the Yerushalmi says, Lo Zaza Misham, they were having a debate back and forth, V'nosim V'nosim B'davar, At Sheheir HaKadosh Baruch Hu Einehim. Until HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself came along and enlightened the leaders of that generation and explained to them why it is that they were allowed to have this institution of Chanukah and Purim. But barring that, without that, we would have had no right to have any institution or any concept of Chanukah and Purim, because that was not a safeguard. That was not in any way meant to be an extension of any other mitzvah. It is totally independent. What we learn from all this is, the bottom line is that every Takana D'Rabbanan, every rabbinic institution, is not something that can just be arbitrary. It's not that they just woke up one day and decided, oh, you know, let's try this, let's try that. Let's institute Chanukah, let's institute Purim. It didn't work that way. It's something that has to fit into a framework. It's something that has to fit into the Klalim, into the rules, as the Rambam explains. And it's something that really has to have a very good justification for why the Chachamim came up with a particular gzeira, which is going to lead us into the discussion about kitnius. What is the justification? We will see in a couple of minutes. By way of introduction to that whole topic, I thought it would be meaningful to go through a very powerful tshuva written by Rav Meshulam Roth. Rav Meshulam Roth was a great Talmud Chacham who was born in 1875 in Poland. He then became a Rav in Romania. And then when the war broke out, he was going through the whole Nazi invasion. Ultimately, in 1949, he ended up moving to Eretz Yisrael and he became a member of the Rabbanut HaRashit in Yerushalayim. And he was a great Talmud Chacham who ultimately published a tshuva sefer that's called Kol Mevaser. Kol Mevaser, right? Everyone knows what that's a reference to. Right, but what's he describing? He's talking about the coming of Mashiach. So Rabbi Meshulam Roth felt in 1949 when he moves to Eretz Yisrael after the ravages of the Holocaust, he says to himself, this has to be the coming of Mashiach. What else can this be? And that's why he refers to his sefer as Kol Mevaser. It's the tshuvas. Many of them are about different issues that the Frum community was confronting at the very beginning of the establishment of the state of Israel, and he has many, many very interesting halachic issues. Okay, so here we have a tshuva by Rav Meshulam Roth, a fascinating historical discussion in his sefer about the permissibility of Jews returning back to Germany after the Shoah. And Rav Meshulam Roth basically writes how here we are the generation who somehow miraculously survived this horrific calamity of the Holocaust. So the Rabbanim of that generation in the late 1940s, early 1950s, felt very strongly that there should be a universal prohibition against any Jew returning back to the land of Germany. Why would you ever go back? How can you go back? What a disgrace to all those who were killed. You're going to go back and support the economy? You're going to go back and pay taxes to the German government? This was a major discussion at the time, obviously a very sensitive discussion to those who were survivors. And he gets into the issue. But in doing so, he basically presents a global issue, which is, do we ever have a right to make a takana in our generation? Or perhaps that was something that was suspended a long time ago. So let's see. Be'inyan hachrazas cheirem al knisas hayehudim legermania. Let's talk about the issue, he says, of Jews returning to Germany after the calamity, after the atrocities of the Germans, of the Nazis in the Holocaust. Al davar shehutza beveidas rabbanim. We had a communal meeting of rabbanim, the hachriz cheirem mitam rabbanei haaretz. They wanted to come out publicly with a cheirem in the name of all the leaders of the generation, shelepiv. And this cheirem would basically say that asur yiyya lechol yehudi, we are going to ban, we are going to forbid any Jew lidroch al admas Germania. No Jew is ever allowed to walk or travel or visit or live in the country of Germany. V'kama rabbanim iskimu l'atza. And there were many leaders of our generation who felt, of course, how can a Jew ever go back? Amnam, and he says, the truth is, mitzad ha'ashkafa, if you think about it from an emotional place, ha'hegyonis v'hamusaris tzodekas ma'od hatzazu, from an emotional perspective, it makes a lot of sense. How can you go back to that country where the streets are filled with blood? How can you go back and be a citizen of such a place? How can you go back and visit and give one dime to such a country? So as far as that is concerned, he says, I don't understand how a Jew doesn't feel on his or her own that intuitively, instinctively, this is something I cannot do. How can I ever go back to Germany? Well, at the same time, he says, that's not the way that halacha is determined. Just because emotionally that's what we feel, or just because intuitively that's what you think, it doesn't mean that we then have a right to get up and say we are putting a cheirem on anyone who goes back to Germany that they have done something wrong, that they have violated a prohibition. Maybe that's going too far. Maybe that's not really an appropriate thing to say. And that's what he's dealing with in this tshuva. He's giving not his emotional response. He says, my emotional response is unequivocal. My emotional response is, as a survivor of the Shoah, it is horrible to go back to Germany. But he's saying, in the context of halacha, would the Rabbanim of our generation have a right to come together and to make such a cheirem, to make such a institution that no one is allowed to go back to Germany post-Holocaust? Look at the next paragraph. Reishis Davar, he says, number one, Ein kochenu yafe bedar hazeh. We don't have the power in this generation, lahachriz al cheirem, v'ligzer iser chadash al kol yehudi b'chol ha'olam. We don't have the right, we don't have the ability, he says, to make an international, all-inclusive, global cheirem against Jews all over the world who want to visit Germany. We don't have that ability. HaRosh from the Sechah Shabbos Kasav, he quotes from the Rosh, Timihani, the Rosh wonders, Eich yachlu haga'onim l'chadish gzeira acher shesasam rabashi hashas. The Rosh wonders, does anyone have a right after the Talmud was completed? After the Amoraim are no longer alive, does anyone in our generation have a right to make a widespread takana, cheirem, gzeira, midirabanan, that is binding on everyone? Is that something that we have the power to do? And that's what he's struggling with here as well. So you can read the whole tshuva on your own. Look at the last few lines. It's on the second side of the page, where he says, make no mistake. Just because we have this discussion about whether or not you're allowed to make a takana, make a gzeira in our generation or post-Gemara, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't take seriously the takanas that the Gemara talks about. Say, for example, a very hot topic around this time of year is always Yom Tov Sheni Shel Galuyos. When I was a young child, I think I was in third grade, we had one of those, not a tournament, like all kids from all over different communities, different schools. They were having like a Yedios Claudios B, whatever it was. Anyway, I made it to like round after round. And then I ended up in this, whatever it was. And the question I got out on was the following, and I'm still scarred from it. The question was, I'm really not, but I still think about it. The question was, who instituted Yom Tov Sheni Shel Galias? And they gave you four options, and one of them was Galias. So I thought that made the most sense, so I wrote Galias. Obviously, it's the wrong answer. Yom Tov Sheni Shel Galias was something that is discussed in the Gemara. Galias lived in the times of Tanakh, so they had nothing to do with each other at all. And that's how I got out. Okay, since then I never forgot how Yom Tov Sheni Shel Galias came to be. What's the story with Yom Tov Sheni Shel Galias? What's the story with Yom Tov Sheni Shel Galias? Where does that come from? You know, many people are advocating that we should get rid of Yom Tov Sheni. Why? Because we have such a chibas Eretz Yisrael. We feel so connected, even though we're here in America. And we live in the United States, but we feel such a beautiful connection to Eretz Yisrael, and therefore we have to only keep one day of Yom Tov, even in Chutz Laretz. You know, I don't often quote my mother in Shir, but my mother had a great line. People are always advocating for only one day of Yom Tov. We're such B'nai Eretz Yisrael. My mother said, here's a litmus test. Imagine if anyone who lived in Eretz Yisrael had to keep 3 days of Yom Tov, and everyone in Chutz Laretz only kept 2 days. Would you still be yearning to be a B'nai Eretz Yisrael? Would you still be advocating for the Shaila? Or would you say like, no, I'll stick with being a Ben Chutz Laretz as long as I can? There's the answer, right? So what's the story with Yom Tov Sheni? Yom Tov Sheni is something that was instituted in the times of Chazal. It's around for a very long time. Now, you may ask a very good question, and that is, the whole reason for Yom Tov Sheni is because when they used to be Mekadesh the Chodesh Al Pi HaRi'iyah, they used to have two witnesses come into the basin and say it's Rosh Chodesh. So if you lived in New York, how were you supposed to know that Rosh Chodesh was declared? You didn't know. There was no way of getting you the message. There was no phone. There was no internet. There was no way of getting the message across the world. So what were you to do? So obviously, you also have the ability to look up at the moon and decide when the moon looks like it's Rosh Chodesh. The problem is, you don't know with precision which day is Rosh Chodesh. So because of a Sveika Diyoma, because we're not sure, is Pesach on this day or is Pesach on the next day, you have to be Machmir for both days. If you lived in Yerushalayim, there's no reason to keep 2 days of Yom Tov. Why? Because in Yerushalayim, the Beis Din let out the message, everybody found out, and everybody knew exactly when it was Rosh Chodesh, and everybody knew exactly when Pesach was. But if you lived in the far-flung countries, or if you lived outside of the Merkaz of the Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael, then maybe the message didn't get to you, and that's why Yom Tov Sheni came to be. Aye, so you'll ask, today we have a fixed calendar. Today we know 100 years in advance when Pesach is going to be in 100 years from now. Anybody here have a knack for that? Right? My son has like a knack for like understanding, you know, calendars. I can't follow anything. Whenever I have a shout about the datelines, I always ask him. I can't follow. My head is spinning whenever someone asks a dateline shot. Are you going this way, going that way, day, which days, whatever. Some people have a knack for this. So if you really understand the theory of the calendar, if you really understand the cheshbon and how this works, then you can predict the next 100 years. Not predict. You know with certainty exactly when everything's going to be. So why do we still have Yom Tov Sheni? It's a really great question. You know who asked this question? Not members of our generation. But the Gemara asked this question. Why do we keep Yom Tov Sheni if Hillel was misaken a calendar? Hillel knew we were going to go into Galus. Hillel knew we were not going to have a Sanhedrin in Yerushalayim. He knew we were not going to do Kiddush HaChodesh. And he knew we were going to have a problem. So he set the calendar then. If Hillel already set the calendar, asked the Gemara, then why do we still have Yom Tov Sheni if we no longer have a Safek? Answers the Gemara, Minig Avoseinu B'Yadeinu. We still do it. Now, why do we still do it is a good question. But the Gemara says we still do it, so you can't get rid of it, says the Rav Meshulam Roth. When we talk about whether or not a generation has a right to make a Takana D'Rabbanan, to make a Gzera D'Rabbanan, don't confuse that with a Gzera that was actually made by Chazal. Once Chazal made a Gzera, it's in play, and you have no right to get rid of it. You can't decide that it's not relevant for your generation anymore. You need to be, as the Gemara says, gadol mimenu b'chachma uv'minyan, in order to repeal a earlier takana of Chazal. So says our Meshulam Roth, let's make no mistake. When Chazal made takanos, we have to abide by them. Let's say, you look at a din d'oraisa on Shabbos, we have all kinds of malacha. You look at The halacha of muktzah on Shabbos, you won't find it. Muktzah on Shabbos is something that is only midirabbanan. Where did muktzah come from? Don't we have enough to worry about on Shabbos without muktzah? Who asked for another thing to be bothered with? Why are we worried about muktzah? So the Rishonim have a whole debate why muktzah came to be. Some Rishonim say it's because we were concerned about hutzah. If you're going to be so used to carrying around your pen and all your other things, then you're going to go outside into the street without an erev and carry your things. If we instituted muktzah, you have to check your pockets before you go out, and then you're going to make sure to empty everything else. That's one opinion in the Rishonim, but be it as it may, muktzah was something that was instituted by the Chachamim as a safeguard. You can't say that today that doesn't apply anymore because of whatever circumstance I face. So says our Meshulam Roth, that's what's very important for us to be aware of when we think about all of these different issues. Take, for example, he writes in the end, in about 1,000 years ago, Rabbeinu Gershom, I think, lived 1,000 years ago. I think he passed away in 1040 or 1050, something like that. Rabbeinu Gershom was referred to as Ma'ar HaGola, the light onto the exile. Rabbeinu Gershom was the greatest of the greats. And yet, Rabbeinu Gershom made a number of takanos. One of them, anybody knows, the most famous? It's relevant to all of you. Everyone in the room. What? Opening someone else's mail is one. What's another one? What? Shaking the lulav all 8 days. No, that's in the Gemara. The Gemara says that. Mishnah says that. But when we talk about Rabbeinu Gershom, the most famous, I think, is not so much about the male. Most famous is that you're not allowed to marry two women. A man is not allowed to marry two women. Even though if you look in the Torah, there's no prohibition at all. But Rabbeinu Gershom said, this is not going to work out well. What are we going to have? A man is going to have to split his attention between two wives. How's that going to work? How's he going to afford all the shoes that he needs to buy for both of them? It's impossible, right? It's not going to work. And therefore, he says that this is something that he abolished. Now, was that adopted by all communities across the board? No, it was not. It was something that Rabbeinu Gershom instituted. Some Ashkenazi communities accepted it. Other Sephardic communities did not accept it. Rabbeinu Gershom didn't have a right to make a takana that was going to be binding for everyone. If communities wanted to take it upon themselves, they did. If they didn't, so they didn't. But again, that's his point, that nobody has the right after Chasimas HaTalmud, after the Torah was transmitted and after the Gemara was completed, nobody has the right to come and make a universal, global Jewish Cheirem or Jewish Takana that is going to be binding on everyone. So this is a struggle and a conflict that we always have to think about whenever we try to figure out the justification for a Takana, for a new rabbinic prohibition, for a new Gzeira Midirabbanan. So let's begin with the story of Kitnius. When we come to Kitnius, we have to ask ourselves, the first question is, there are a number of areas in halacha that require us to have something that is referred to as lecha. Where are the places in halacha where we need to have lecha? Number one, the Torah says that on Leil HaSeder we have to eat matzah, which is lechem oni. So it needs to be bread. We have the mitzvah of hafrashas challah. The only time you have to be mafresh challah is when you're dealing with something that is halachically defined as bread. The only time the Torah says you have to bench birchas hamazon is when you're dealing with something that is actually halachic bread. And v'chahena v'chahena, the bracha of hamotzi lechem min ha'aretz is midrabanan, but it's only on bread. Netilas yadayim, washing one's hands, is only something that we do before eating bread. It's not something that we have to do for other food items. So the question then becomes, if we have a requirement that matzah has to be made according to the halachic definition of bread, how do we actually define what bread is? So we have a Gemara, and the Gemara is very clear. Let's read number Beis. Psachim daf lamed hayam ad aleph. Says the Gemara, Eilu dvarim shadam yotza mehem yidei chavasa bepesach. I have to make matzah. Which ingredient is able to be included in the matzah? What can I use in order to have it defined halachically as bread that can be used on Pesach as matzah? Now again, bread and matzah are the same. The only difference is bread, you bake it for a long time, and matzah is very thin, and you take it out of the oven right away. So you didn't give it a chance to rise. You didn't give it a chance to become chametz. Okay. Says the Gemara in Maseches Pesachim Daf Lamed Hei, what are the different items that are acceptable to be the main ingredient in the matzah in order for it to be considered acceptable for Pesach? Says the Gemara, b'chitim, b'saorim, b'kusman, shifon, and shibola shuol. It's wheat, barley, oats, rye, and spelt. Those are the only five items that can be used in order to make matzah properly for the mitzvah on Pesach. If I use something else, what would be a something else? What would be a good example of a something else?
Rice.
Rice flour. What about instead of using wheat flour, I use rice flour? It's very clear in the Mishnah that if I use rice flour, it would not be acceptable for the mitzvah of matzah on Leil HaSeder. Good? Says the Gemara. Let's read the Gemara. Hani in orez v'dochen lo. Says the Gemara, the clear implication of this statement is that the only items I can use in order to produce matzah are wheat, barley, oats, rye, and spelt. But if I'm going to use rice flour, it will not be acceptable for the mitzvah of matzah. Why not? Says the Gemara, where does that come from? Amar kura lo sochal alav chametz, shivas yamim tochal alav matzos. The Torah says, you're not allowed to eat chametz, and you have to eat matzah. Both of those statements are put one next to the other. Not just coincidentally, it's there to teach one from the other. That the only thing that could be acceptable as matzah is an item which, if I would have left it long enough, could have potentially become chametz. But if I have an item that, as long as I would leave it, and as much as I would bake it, it would never turn into chametz at all, then that would not be an acceptable item for the mitzvah of matzah on Pesach. Okay, so that's what the Gemara says. And therefore, since if I had rice, and I made rice flour, and I baked with that, and I left it sitting in the water, and I then kneaded it, and whatever, I did everything that I do to make bread, it would never turn into chametz as long as I would wait. Therefore, that ingredient cannot be used in preparing the matzah for Pesach. Okay, is that clear? Clear. Now, the Gemara then brings the opinion of Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri. Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri disagrees, and he says, what are you talking about? Rice flour is the same thing as wheat flour. And the same way wheat flour can turn into chametz, so too rice flour can turn into chametz. And therefore, since rice flour is able to turn into chametz, therefore, rice is going to be an acceptable ingredient to produce the matzah with. Now, any of you have a question on that dispute? Is there something that bothers you about that? What? No, there should be something that bothers you about it. What should bother you about it?
If it's not one of the five things, it's not one of the five things.
No, so he says there should be six. Okay, he has a right to say there are six. That's not what should bother you. What should bother you is, how are they disagreeing about a machlokas and metzius? What is the dispute here? The dispute is, if I would leave rice flour long enough, would it turn into chametz? I had a great idea. Why don't you try it? Why don't you do an experiment and see what happens? And prove one opinion right or wrong. How do you ever have a dispute where we're talking about something of this nature where we can so easily test it out? So then what's the fight? What's the argument? Did nobody think, you know, you're sitting there academically having a discussion in the Beis Medrash, oh, is rice flour considered flour or not? You know what? Somebody go get us a bowl. Let's put the rice flour in. Let's put the wheat flour in. Let's see what happens. Is it the same chemical reaction afterward or not? So what's the dispute? So the Ramban quotes in the name of the Yerushalmi that obviously that's not what they're fighting about. They did an experiment. They brought a bowl in and they put the wheat flour in and they brought another bowl and they put the rice flour in. And they watched what the chemical reaction would be. Would it start rising? Would it start cracking? What would happen? Would it start bubbling over? That's what they were wondering. The question then became, as they looked at the chemical reaction to the rice flour and they saw it was a little bit different than the wheat flour, the question then became, is that reaction considered chametz or not? Everyone agreed to what they saw. Everyone agreed that this is having some kind of reaction. The question then was, how do we interpret the data that we have? How do we look at this? Does it now mean that this is considered to be in the category of chametz? Or does it mean that, no, this is not yet at the threshold of chametz, and therefore it is to be left out of the category of five? That's what the dispute is all about. And basically what the Yerushalmi is teaching us, as the Ramban quotes, is there is no such thing as a machlokas and metzius. Chazal weren't that silly. Chazal obviously did an experiment wherever they have the ability to do so. The only dispute that they have is, how do you then interpret the results of that experiment? That's what they dispute. What does it mean? So that's really what this is about. Okay. The Gemara Maseches Pesachim Kuf Yudalet Amud Beis tells us, Leis dechash lahad Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri. This is a completely rejected opinion. Nobody accepts it at all, even as a possibility. And we believe that rice flour is not able to be chametz at all, and therefore cannot be used to bake the matzah. Now, if rice cannot become into chametz, then what is kidneys all about? It's clear in the Gemara that rice can never be chametz. So what are we concerned about? Let's read the Rambam. The Rambam writes, Ein aser mishum chametz bePesach ala chameshes minei dagan milvad. There is no prohibition of having chametz on Pesach unless it is from one of the five grains that are outlined in the Gemara. Skip a line. Avala kidneys. But if I have beans, or I have orez v'doch, and I have rice, upulim v'adashim, ein b'hem mishum chametz. There is no prohibition of chametz at all, and says the Rambam, he gives an extreme case. Afilu lash kemach orez. If I take rice flour, and I put it into hot water, usually hot water is able to make something rise quicker, or bubble over quicker, v'chiseu b'begadim, and then I cover it over, usually that also makes it rise more quickly, ad shenitapeach kamo batek shehechmetz, Hareza muter ba'achila she'en zachimetz, says the Rambam, this is not called chametz, and rice can never become chametz. The Rambam adopts the position of the Gemara, which is clear in the Gemara. So where does this whole idea, where does this whole notion of kidneys come from? You look in the Rishonim, the Maharil and Hilchas Pesach, and the Trumas Hadeshon talks about it, and the Ritva, and other Rishonim, and the Mordechai, the Bali Atosas have big discussions about this whole origin of kidneys. There are two main reasons that are quoted in the Rishonim. Reason number one is the following. There are many fields that grow rice right next to the fields that are growing wheat. The concern is when you do the harvest, you're going to have many wheat kernels that are going to be part of the harvest of the rice. And therefore, when you process it into flour, you're actually going to have a nice percentage of flour that's going to be from the wheat as opposed to from the rice. And therefore, that flour can turn into chametz. That's the concern. Concern number two that the Rishonim say is, somebody who looks into my kitchen is going to see me using flour in a recipe on Pesach. Now, they don't know that I'm using rice flour. All they see is white powder going into the ingredients. They're going to assume, oh, Schechter is my rabbi, and Schechter is using flour on Pesach. It must be that there's no problem at all to use wheat flour on Pesach. Not realizing that what I'm using is really rice flour that can never become chametz, and someone's going to make a mistake. And therefore we say, you cannot use rice flour either because we have a concern that the kidneys is going to be mixed up with the real chametz. Those are the two considerations that are given by the Rishonim. Now, are those relevant today? Good question. Very good question. The second chashash I think is extremely relevant because people can still make a mistake when they see what you're doing. The first chashash may be less so. First chashash I would say, probably since we have so many people who are allergic to all kinds of different ingredients. So if you had a rice field where wheat, there was a concern that maybe there was wheat that was going to be processed in the rice, the company will get sued, right? You can't sell rice with wheat kernels in it. The company won't be able to survive because somebody has a wheat allergy. They're going to end up buying the rice flour and they're going to get sick from it. So maybe that consideration is no longer as relevant as it once was. While we're on that topic, it's just an interesting thing to be aware of. How many in the room are makban on Chol Yisrael? No one, right? So why are we not makban on Chol Yisrael? You look in the Gemara Maseches Avodah Zarah. The Gemara says that chalav shechal bo akum, if you have meat, if you have milk that was milked by, that was extracted from an animal by a non-Jew, you're not allowed to drink it. You're not allowed to consume it. So chalav stam means it was extracted from the animal by a non-Jew. So why do we all consume chalav stam? The answer is, Rav Moshe Feinstein writes a breakthrough tshuva, monumental tshuva, which, by the way, in the end, he pulls it back a little bit, but nobody remembers the end. Rav Moshe writes in the tshuva as follows. What's the whole reason why we're not allowed to have chalav that was milked by a non-Jew? The reason why is because there's a concern. Maybe he's going to present you a bottle of milk. You're not going to realize that that milk is really camel's milk. And he ran out of cow's milk. He had none left today. And he knows that his customers need milk. So he's going to go to a non-kosher animal, milk the animal, and sell that bottle of milk with a sticker on it with a label that says cow's milk. You're not going to realize that you're drinking milk from a non-kosher animal. That's the concern. Says Rav Moshe, living in the United States when we have the FDA, and if a milk plant ever dared to fill up a bottle of milk instead of being cow milk, if they would fill it up with something else, they would be shut down the next moment, the next day. Therefore, says Rav Moshe, that's a strong enough shmirah, that's a strong enough safeguard to make sure that nothing's going to go wrong. How do you have Chol Yisrael? It means a Jew has to actually milk the cow? No. means a Jew has to oversee the milking of the cows. Says Rav Moshe, this is even better than that. The FDA is stronger than a Jew standing over and watching. Because the company knows that if they do something wrong, they're going to be shut down. So that would be a strong enough consideration. So the problem that some people don't realize is that this applies in the United States, where we have a very strong regulation from the FDA. But let's say you go to other countries where they don't have that kind of situation that is set up with the government. And companies know that if they do something wrong, all they're going to get is a little fine, but they're not going to be shut down, and it's not such a big deal. So if, for whatever reason, there would be some major epidemic in the cow industry, if there would be a major epidemic in the cow industry, and they weren't able to milk the cows, and as a result of that, they have to then rely on camel milk. You know, they say to themselves, we're willing to take the fine, but we're going to sell the customers whatever they need anyway. You have to realize when you go to other communities, it's not as simple. What's it like in Chile?
I think they're lying, but I know that Argentina, which is actually a corrupt country, like very much corrupt, and there's a very big rabbi there, you know, mm-hmm. very liable.
Yeah.
And he, I think he himself is mandering halal stuff, but uh-huh. he just...
It could be he knows something about about the inner workings.
Cows are the thing that's most available there. So I don't know if that counts.
Uh-huh. So I don't know the details, but again, when you go traveling abroad, you have to look into it. You have to really think whether or not the laws are going to be the same and whether or not, therefore, there's this consideration the same way we have it in the United States. It's not necessarily the same. Anyway, this is something that the Rishonim talk about with regard to Kidneyas on Pesach. Kidneyas on Pesach, the discussion is, why do we have a concern? Again, as we mentioned, either it's because somebody's going to see me and they're going to then make a mistake because they think I'm using flour that's made out of wheat. Or consideration number two is somebody is going to use the processed flour that they think is only from rice or from corn, and then it turns out that there's really wheat that's mixed inside because they grow one right next to the other. Okay, those are the two concerns. Now, Ashkenazim take it as a given that kidneys are problematic on Pesach. What's fascinating is it's really not so simple. The Beis Yosef in the 1500s records the controversy, records the discussion. Let's learn through the Beis Yosef together. Here a number, Dalet, says the Beis Yosef. Yesh osru nechal orez v'chol mini kitnios. There are those who are careful on Pesach not to eat rice. Says the Beis Yosef, v'chumra yisera yizu. This is something that is an extra stringency. I don't really understand it. Kamra ben Yeruchim kasav. Osam shenagu shalo lechal orez v'mini kitnios mavushu b'pesach. Minik shtosu. Says the Beis Yosef, this is nonsensical. Why would you not eat kidneys on Pesach? After all, the Gemara says that kidneys, that orez, that rice can never become chametz. So what's your concern? Then he goes further and he says, Venira, skip three lines. Shalom Nagubah Isra Mishum Chimutz. He says, I don't understand why anybody would consider this chametz. Listen carefully. Delo to inshi bazed de tinoka shal b'israben yodin oso. Every young child knows what the Gemara says in Psachim Daf Lamed Hey, of course. And therefore, says the Beis Yosef, who would ever make a mistake? Everybody knows that there are only five items that can become chametz. And if you have rice, it will never become chametz. Isn't that what the Gemara says in Psachim Daf Lamed Hey? Now, I would say most adults in our generation don't know that Gemara. But the Beis Yosef says, Tinoka Shal Beis Rabban Yodin, every second grader knows that. So who's going to make a mistake? Who's going to make a mistake? Therefore, says the Beis Yosef, if you look in the last line, Leis lechash lidvarim halalu zulasi ha'ashkenazim. Nobody's worried about this except our friends the Ashkenazim down the block. But none of us are concerned because this makes no sense. Why would you be concerned? Now, maybe the Beis Yosef is living in a very learned community where everybody knows the Gemara Psachim Daf Lamed Hey, and the Ramah comes along and says, look, I am the rabbi of the Ashkenazim here in Krakow and nobody knows anything. I don't know. But the Ramah comes along and he says, Anu, b'nei Ashkenaz nagul hachmir. Yes, Beis Yosef, you're right. Us, the Ashkenazim, are concerned about this issue. And we do think that there's room to make a mistake. And we are nervous that maybe someone is going to confuse it. And therefore, says the Ramah, the Ashkenazim have taken upon themselves that they are machmir to make sure not to have kidneys. So this has been adopted by the Ashkenazi communities as standard practice. So much so that the Chumash Hadeshen, who was the Rebbe of the Ramah quotes so much from the Trumas Hadeshen, the Trumas Hadeshen has the following question. When we say that you're not allowed to eat kidneys on Pesach, Does that mean that I also have to dispose of any kidneys in my house? Am I in violation of Bayira Bayimatse? We know you're not allowed to have chametz around in the house. So does that mean that I'm also not allowed to have kidneys around in my house? Or it just means I shouldn't eat it? That's the shayla of the Trumas Hadeshim. It shows you how accepted this takana became. So much so that people were asking, do I have to get rid of it from my house before Pesach? So what's the answer? What's the answer? You have to get rid of it? No. Why not? Says the Trumas Hadeshim, an amazing line. In hu achli va'anan lo mashinan. You're going to tell me, says the Trumas Hadeshim, that our friends, the Ashkenazim, who are living in their communities, are going to be sitting and feasting on their rice on Pesach, and I, the Ashkenazic Jew, is not even allowed to have it in my house? Doesn't make sense. You're going to go so much to the extreme, that's too far. That's going too far. And therefore, says the Trumas Hadeshim, the minhag has become that we don't eat kidneys as Ashkenazim. However, he writes, we do allow kidneys to be left in the house, in the home on Pesach, because there is no concern. And that is why the Ramah writes in Siman Tafnun Gimel, that the Ashkenazim are noheg not to have kidneys on Pesach. However, he says, im nafal l'toch hakedera, if a piece of corn falls into my recipe, and I'm cooking for Pesach, he says, I shouldn't get rid of it. Why should I not get rid of it? Because it's batal l'shishim, it's going to be lost in the mixture, and now it's all mixed into the vegetable soup, and it's not chametz. All it is a chumrah. So therefore, he says, we wouldn't have to be concerned about that. What's fascinating about this is, how many of you have heard of Rabbi Yaakov Emden? Rabbi Yaakov Emden was a very famous personality, but his father was even more famous. Who was his father? Nobody knows? Rabbi Yaakov Emden's father was the Chacham Tzvi. Chacham Tzvi was a great posek, a very important personality in halacha. So Rabbi Yaakov Emden quotes in the name of his father, and it's so important. Anytime we take a chumrah upon ourselves, we always have to think about the balance of what that chumrah is going to do to the overall situation. So often a chumrah is maybe lidei kula. So often we're well-intentioned, but we don't realize that by taking this chumrah upon ourselves, we are actually making some other sacrifice on the other end. Take, for example, a classic example is someone wants to be machmer in Hilchas Nida. A husband or a wife wants to be machmer in one direction or the other. So it's very nice you want to be machmer, but the Torah says that the mitzvah of Ona is a mitzvah for a husband and wife to take care of each other, to be with each other. And now, you want to be machmer, does it really make sense? Now, sometimes it does, other times it doesn't. You have to really think about it very carefully. Second example, let's say, I once read a story in the Sefer Halicha Shlomo, that Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was walking down the block in Shari Chesed one Shabbos, and he sees a young boy walking with his father, a high school boy walking with his father, and he sees that the father is schlepping a big stack of chairs, and the young boy is standing next to him, not holding any. So he turns to him and he says, how come you're not? So he says, I'm machmir, I don't hold by the Erev in Yerushalayim. I don't carry in the Erev in Yerushalayim. So Shlomo Zalman said, that's very nice. But the Torah says, Kabed es avicha v'asimecha. So it's very nice you want to take a chumrah upon yourself, but look what it's at the expense of. Does that actually make sense? So you have to always balance and weigh very carefully what the outcome is going to be of any chumrah you take upon yourself. And even when you're very well intentioned, sometimes you may not realize the collateral damage of a chumrah and what it's going to do. So here's one of those examples. Rabbi Yaakov Emden quotes in the name of his father that his father, the Chacham Tzvi, wanted to get rid of this minhag of kidneys that the Ashkenazim have adopted. Why? What can possibly be bad about it? What do you think? Where can there possibly be a negative outcome from this minhag of kidneys? What does it bother anyone? So I won't eat kidneys. It's okay. Yeah? So that's a great point. I would have said, because you're causing a divide in the Jewish community. Many communities have Ashkenazim and Sephardim living together, especially today. And now all of a sudden you have to be careful. Ashkenazi may not want to have a Sephardi over in the house because they're not going to serve them what they like to eat. And a Sephardi may not be able to have an Ashkenazi because all their pots and pans have cooked rice in it. So maybe you would say that's a reason. Nope, that's not what he says. He says an even more concerning comment. Here's what he writes. If you're going to say that all kidneys is off limits on Pesach, then what's left to eat? Matzah. Imagine you go to the matzah bakery and you tell them how many pounds of matzah you're going to need for Pesach because you have nothing else to eat. Every single meal is going to be matzah. And every main course of every meal is also going to be matzah, because what else are you left with? How is it possible that the matzah bakery is going to bake the matzah properly when they're under so much pressure to bake tons of pounds of matzah? It's impossible. And therefore, said the Chacham Tzvi, it's going to turn out that they're going to end up making matzah that's really chametz, because they're not going to be so careful. And you're going to end up eating chametz bePesach because you're so worried about your kidneys, that's really nothing to be concerned about. Amazing. So that's what the Chacham Tzvi is quoted by his son, Rabbi Yaakov Emden. He quotes that his father is very concerned about this whole institution that the Ashkenazim took upon themselves of kidneys on Pesach. And his concern was that the negative outcome that's going to result on achilas chametz is something that makes the whole chumrah not worth it at all. Fascinating. Very fascinating point. Okay. Because the whole prohibition of kidneys is only a gzeira midrabanan that was instituted much later in the days of the Ashkenazic Rishonim, therefore the Chayyadim writes that if you have somebody who's bedochak, ve'eino mayochal, somebody is stuck somewhere in a community and they don't have Pesach products and you don't have anything else to eat, not that you're going to die, but you're very limited. So says the Chayyadim, of course, you're allowed to eat kidneys. That's not where the gzeira was set. And similarly, my father told me if you have someone who's a chole, so it doesn't mean you have to be a chole sheyesh basakana. Somebody called me the other day and they said that they have a parent who's 99 years old and their diet consists of very few food items every day. Baruch Hashem, pretty healthy person, but their diet consists of a very limited amount of options. And one of the things that they drink every day is Ensure. Ensure. Now, Ensure is filled with vitamins or whatever is in there. And I think that that's a very important staple of somebody's diet at that stage of life, when especially they're not eating anything else. So they asked me, it has kidneys in it. So to me, it's pashut. There's no shaila. Of course you allow the person. I said I wouldn't even bring it up to the person at all. Don't say anything. Just let them keep eating or drinking their regular diet. Because when we say the whole gzeira of kidneys is something that is only midrabanan, it's something that came along in the days of the Rishonim. It's something that half of the Jewish community didn't even accept upon themselves. And it's something that from the outset was never intended for someone who was in an uncomfortable situation like a cholet, or somebody who's in an uncomfortable situation like somebody who needs the Ensure. I don't know if I mentioned to you, but I got a shiloh last week from somebody who 16 years ago took upon themselves that they were going to be gluten-free and vegan. Did I say this in class? Gluten-free and vegan. I don't know if those two things go together usually. Yes, no, I don't know. So this was a voluntary decision that the person was going to be gluten-free and vegan. So the question now is, what they did for matzah over the last 16 years, don't ask. I have no idea. Oh. What? Oh, matzah. Oh. So when I was asked the question, I said, first of all, what do you do about matzah? And they're like, oh, we don't eat matzah. I'm like, you don't eat matzah. That's a mitzvah midaraisa. It's not like you're sick. So I said, you have to get the oat matzah, which is not so easy to get. You have to arrange in advance. They never heard of it. They were never aware of it. So at least we took care of that. I said, okay, now to your shiloh. What's the question? They want to know, are we able to eat kidneys on Pesach? Because we have very little option of what to eat on Pesach because of this very restricted diet. Now this is an interesting shiloh. The reason why it's a shiloh is because if somebody was a chole, of course we would say, you're allowed to eat kidneys on Pesach. Would you really designate this person as a chole? It's a self-inflicted chole. You decided that you're a chole. You decided that I'm not going to eat gluten and I'm not going to have, and I'm going to be a vegan. That's your problem. Stop with the mishigas. Get back to being like everybody else and go eat like everyone else does. And then you won't have a heter to eat kidneys. Or would you say, no, at this point, 16 years later, if this person is going to start eating these items, their stomach is going to have problems, right? 16 years of not having these things and then all of a sudden you're going to switch. It's not going to be so simple. You're not going to feel well. So maybe we should say, well, was it right 16 years ago for you to take this upon yourself? Maybe yes, maybe no. Was it right, especially knowing that you weren't going to eat matzah or ever have challah on Shabbos? It's terrible. It's a terrible decision to make. But okay, now you are where you are. Now you are where you are. I think at this point you are a cholet. Again, because the threshold of allowing someone to eat kidneys on Pesach is not that you have to be extremely sick without it. It's that you're very uncomfortable. Like the Chayyadim says, if you have a very limited amount of food to eat, so then that's what you do. The reason why you have this limited diet is only because it's self-inflicted. I gave an example, which please don't misunderstand. I don't think it's exactly the same, but it was the first thing that came to my mind, and maybe it's not a good example. So please take it with that understanding. I thought about someone who's anorexic, right? So I was called last week about someone who's anorexic, and they have a very limited amount of things that they're willing to eat. And I said, are you kidding? If I had someone who was an anorexic, who was really sick, I would give him chametz with Pesach. What's the question? We were talking about someone who's anorexic and in the hospital, someone who's really sick. So Rachmana Litzlan, it's a terrible condition. So what would you say? Just because, so here's the sticky part. It's not exactly the same, because I wouldn't say anorexia is self-inflicted. It's a, I would venture to say most agree that it's a mental illness. If you speak to someone with anorexia, you realize that it's true. They can't wrap their heads around the concept of eating like everybody else. So that's why it's not exactly the same. But it's what came to mind, that would you say this person is not deemed a chola because the food's right in front of you, go eat it? No, that doesn't work. Right now, in my condition where I am, this is where I'm up to. So I think anorexia is a bad example anyway, because anorexia is something that if the person was really sick, we would give them actual chametz to eat. We wouldn't stop just by having kidneys. We would give them whatever they need. You have a question?
Yeah, but how could eating kidneys be mutter if, like, they can literally eat anything non-gebrux and it would be gluten-free?
Non-gebrux.
Non-gebrux is, yeah, like, would be gluten-free. Literally anything non-gebrux.
Okay, but they're also vegan.
Okay, so don't eat meat.
Yeah, I look. I,
like, how could that be, like, how could that give a head there for
us? Look, they're saying that their diet is extremely limited. And
but did you give a head there for it?
I think if the facts, again, I can only deal with the facts that are given to me. I think if the facts that you're presenting are correct and are accurate, this is the proper answer. I think if you're over-exaggerating and you really have many things to eat and you're just, you know, whatever, so that's not on me. I don't know. Yeah?
When we say, I want to get to the point where we say, like, offend anyone, but would we say it's like someone who got sick because they decided to smoke? So then, let's say they...
Why is that offensive?
I don't know. No, like, some people make bad decisions. I don't want to offend anyone.
Really bad decisions. They die from them. Yeah.
Right. Would that be...
You know, there's a big discussion whether or not you're allowed to smoke on Yontif, right? You've looked into this? You've heard about it before? Okay, good. It shouldn't be relevant to anyone. We shouldn't look into it. There's a big discussion whether or not you're allowed to smoke on Yontif. My father always says, Rav Breuer, who was a great Talmud Chacham, he was the Rav of Breuer's. He came from Europe, and they had this minhag that all the members of the shul used to come over on Yontif, on the second day of Yontif, to visit his house, whatever, Sukkot and Pesach. And part of the tradition was that he would give out cigars on the second day of Yontif. He would give out cigars and everyone would go light them and smoke cigars. That's, again, this was 50 years ago, but that's what everyone used to do. So there's a big discussion about smoking on Yontif. Are you allowed to light the fire? Is it really Shabbat l'chol nefesh? Is it something that everyone does? Not whatever, a big major discussion. So every time Rav Asher Weiss talks about it, every time I've heard him talk about it, he always adds the following line. He says, before we get into the discussion, there's nothing really to discuss because the Gemara has a rule, Ein Isser Chal Al Isser. So you're not allowed to smoke in the first place. So there's no discussion to be had about Yom Tov. Rav Moshe writes, you're not allowed to smoke. He says if you have someone who's addicted to smoking, okay, that's where the discussion begins. But to start smoking is something that's a terrible thing to do. So yeah, now back to your question.
Okay, so let's say someone got a lung condition, God forbid, because they smoked.
Mm-hmm.
And then now, I don't know, they have a dietary restriction and they can only eat kidney.
Yeah.
Would that be considered?
In the end of the day, you're a chola now. Let me give you a different example that comes to mind. I think the Minchas Chinuch talks about it. I didn't have a chance to look it up, but I think the Minchas Chinuch talks about the following case. He says, what's the halacha if I see that somebody, Rachmana Litzlan, is about to lose their life? So what do I have to do? Osamar Adam Riecha, the Torah says, I have to go save them. So the Gemara says, we have a pasuk v'hashevosalo, which means if somebody loses their item, I have to go and return it to them. I see a wallet in the middle of the street. I have to pick it up and give it back. Hashavas Aveda, says the Gemara. Hashavas Gufo, of course. If somebody's drowning in the swimming pool and I know how to save them, of course, if I have to give back your wallet, of course I have to give back your life. So I should jump into the pool, assuming it's not a risk to my life because I know how to swim. I have to jump into the pool, take the person out as a kal v'chomer from Hashavas Aveda. Okay. Says the Menchas Chinuch. 1 second. If that whole halacha is learned from the rules that govern Hashavas Aveda, what will be in the following case? What if somebody decides, doesn't care about his money? So I take my wallet, I throw it out the window. It was done willingly. It's because I don't care. I take $100 bills, I start walking through the streets of Manhattan, throwing them out. Is there a mitzvah hashavas aveda for you to go start collecting the dollar bills? If it flies out of my pocket and I don't realize, then of course hashavas aveda. But what if I decide to throw it out of my pocket? What if I decide that I want to throw money all over the streets? That's not an aveda. That's something that I decided to get rid of. That's not something that's lost. That's something that I have chosen to destroy. So in such a case, there would be no mitzvah of hashavas aveda. What's the halacha if somebody willingly decides to go and take their own life? So I see somebody standing at the edge of a bridge, Rahmana Litzlan. Do I have to go and save them? Or do I say, no, hashavas aveda? The rules of hashavas aveda are only if it's something that's an aveda. But this is not an aveda. You're choosing to do that. Am I mechuyev to save that person or not? I think contemporary psychologists would say, no, obviously the person has a mental illness and oh, let them, whatever, fine. Leaving that all aside, a person stands there and says, I have nothing wrong with me at all. I know with a full heart exactly what I'm doing, and I'm doing this because I think there's absolutely no reason to live. Not because I have any psychological problem, but because I think that theologically it makes much more sense to be dead than to be alive.
Well, the person's not an owner of his or her own body.
What? No, they're not allowed to do it. That's clear. Of course they're not allowed to do it.
It's not that you're returning their aveda. You're returning
someone else's. Yeah. Okay, that's an interesting point. So the Minchas Chinuch gets into this. Like, do we say just because it's self-inflicted, therefore it would change the rules? Or do you say, no, you look at the person where they are right now and size up the condition as it's presenting itself right now and then make a decision? So that's, I don't know, it's not exactly the same, but it's something that reminds me. Anyway, let me just make one final point. Before we end, I see it's already time to finish. Rav Moshe has a major, major chiddush, a very important chiddush, where he writes, when we talk about kidneys in general, what's included in the category of kidneys and what is not is always a very complicated question. It's a very complicated question. I was in the supermarket this week doing Pesach shopping, and there was a product there, a spice, where there were two hashgachas on it. But the two hashgachas were conflicting hashgachas. The hashgacha on top was the OU, and it said OUP, kosher for all year and Passover. The hashgacha right under it was a different hashgacha, where it said kosher all year, but not for Passover. So I took a picture of it, I sent it to the OU, and I said, is this a mistake? What does that mean? You're disagreeing whether or not this is usable for Pesach? So he said, yes, this is what we're disagreeing about. How far do we expand the category of kidneys, and where does it end? Rav Moshe Feinstein writes in a Tshuva and Arachayim Chelek Gimel, Simon Samach Gimel, that Havu de Lodosef Hala, the whole Chumra of kidneys in the first place was a Chiddush. So now you're going to go and expand the category and keep expanding and expanding. Every time we come up with something, we're going to say it's us or also says Rav Moshe, no, whatever the Rishonim said was us or is where it stops, and we're not going to add to that category, we're going to leave it as it is. You know that the Chai Adam in the 1800s said that potatoes are kidneys. Can you imagine if we would have Pesach without potatoes? My father said they used to make fun. They said the Chai Adam's real name should be the Kitzer Adam. He's trying to kill everyone. Like, how are we going to survive Pesach without potatoes? That's not his joke. He said that's what they used to say. Right? How could it be? But it makes a lot of sense. Why are potatoes different than anything else? You make potato starch, right? So why should there be any difference between potatoes and all the other kidneys? But Rav Moshe writes, why is it that potatoes are okay? It's because Havudullah Losevala. We're not going to add on to the Takana of kidneys. We're not going to put new things into the category. Whatever it was, and whatever is not included is not included. And based on that is where the major dispute in today's poskim come up with quinoa. Right? Quinoa was not around in the days of the Rishonim. And the question now becomes, are we allowed to use quinoa on Pesach because we say we're not going to extend the category of kidneys to something new that we just discovered? Or are we going to say, no, quinoa is the same as all these other beans, as all these other categories, and therefore there should be no distinction at all between quinoa and everything else? That is a very important discussion. The Shari Tshuva, on the side of the Shulchan Aruch, the Shari Tshuva writes that he believes coffee is part of the category of kidneys. Thankfully, we don't accept his opinion. But that's what the Shari Tshuva writes. And when you think about it, why should he be wrong? What should be the difference between that and any other bean? Coffee beans are the same beans as anything else. And you grind them up and you make them into a flour. Why should there be any difference? So this is the issue of kidneys. Very fascinating issue. A lot more to talk about, but I see our time is up. So, Amir Tzashem.